Hello, good evening, everybody. Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much. This is the fourth, actually, in a series of Kebab Irreverent. May I introduce to you the Reverend David Isherwood. Now, it's a real question of hold on to your hats here, because we're going to have to try to deal with a very, 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 very long life in in 45 minutes. So, good luck. Okay, so, David, you were born in Bangor in 1946, April 1946.
That's Bangor in Wales.
Don't interrupt me. Just give me a chance. Born in Bangor in 1946, but then very rapidly moved to New Zealand. Why was that?
Because Bangor wasn't ready for me. Because my father was a New Zealander and he wasn't demobbed, and he went back to New Zealand to demob, having first married my mother and Elizabeth Rosemary Morris, and me born on the 1st of April 1946, and by September we were going back to New Zealand on a boat.
Okay, and so that's fine. Yeah. So can I just make a request, David, that I know you're very, very sort of effusive with your arm movements, but when you do that...
Don't do that.
Yes, exactly. Do it with the other arm, yes. So tell us about New Zealand. Tell us about your time in New Zealand, because you were there for seven years.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's great. My memories of New Zealand are always, always good. My brother was born out there, so he's a real Kiwi. I'm just an interloper. A lot of Welsh people in New Zealand, like there are a lot of Welsh people in South America as well. And Welsh is still spoken in South America, by the way, but that's not the script.
No, it's not.
So let's keep going. School there. I fell in love, kind of, at the age of six with Alison Whitmore, who lived opposite us, whose father was an architect, who decided to build his own house at the end of the road, Wiringa Road, Days Bay, opposite Wellington. And he had a daughter called Alison, and she dared me to climb a railway line, and I climbed it for her. And fell off, broke my arm, I broke her heart, but I broke my arm, and that was my introduction. This is something I haven't told you. I went to hospital.
David, just a second. We spent 3 hours preparing this. So far, I've only heard one thing I've heard before. Keep going.
So I went to hospital, and I was kept in overnight for a green stick fracture. That's when everybody was cautious in the New Zealand equivalent of the NHS. And I was in hospital in a junior ward, and there were four beds, and there was this glass bottle by the side of the cabinet. And my first instinct at the age of six was to lift it up and look at it and ask for water to be put in it, which you don't do.
Nice.
Because you're meant to fill it.
Yes, absolutely. So what was school like for you, David?
School was very good. Janet and John books. I learnt to read in New Zealand. I also came across this terrible New Zealand thing about trying to ape the British in corporal punishment. So when we finished the day, we all lined up with a senior school opposite us, and those who had miscreants in the school, in the senior school, were publicly strapped by the headmaster, who went along in a line. So I thought, I'm not going to be part of that. I don't want to do that. So I persuaded my parents to come back too.
Okay.
No, I didn't.
But, you know. So it's basically public flogging.
Public flogging, yeah. We were just very slow in catching up with you, really.
One of the things that you said that was particularly interesting was Waitangi Day.
Waitangi Day is when you kind of celebrate the accord between the Maori and the settlers, and it doesn't work. To this day, it still doesn't work. Nobody's got the hang of how it's going to work at all. But the local greengrocer came in. I remember it so well. He came in to demonstrate a Maori haka, a Maori dance, and it was a really hot day. And then I believed for the first time that all Maori sweated, and underneath was a white stripe, because he cocoed himself up. as a white, you know, he cokered himself up, never forgotten it, and streaks of white down him. And that was my introduction to the great cultural festival called Waitangi Day.
But obviously there were lots of Maoris around.
Yeah, lots of Maoris. They would often be on the shore of around Wellington, just picking up in the most wonderful way seafood for the day. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you've got a sort of a great affinity for New Zealand.
We've been back three times.
Yes. Well, that's pretty much an affinity. So your first track relates to that. New Zealand.
Yeah. The haka. My father was able to dance the haka. He was a great rugby player, and he would, on New Zealand, he would always dance this. And this scares the living daylights out of me every time I see it happen. It just, my blood curdles when I hear this.
I was thinking that it is quite a scary thing, and I do think that what would be scarier for the English team, English rugby team, would be then to sort of do Morris dancing in return. And that would,
yes. Yeah, that would do them.
Yeah. Anyway, so tell us about your journey back to the UK.
The journey back from the UK was by boat, the Royal Mail ship Rangitata, and then I found out in 2007 that John Prescott was a steward, as a young steward on that boat, working for the White Star Line or something like that. I can't remember, somewhere on those lines. So somehow or another, he had an introduction to my life, or I had an introduction to his. We stopped at Pitcairn Islands on the way across, and that was the first time I saw a black man, for the first time, a man of colour. And I was in a market. We'd come off the ship into a market, and I was wandering with my father, holding onto my father's hand, and this guy just came to me face to face, and he looked at me and opened his eyes, and he smiled. And it was the biggest smile I think I'd ever seen in all my life. And it prepared me for what was going to come later on. It was extraordinary.
Okay. And so you then went to Holyhead.
We went to Holyhead. My mother's parents lived in Holyhead. So in order to find a flat that we could rent in London, the children, that's Gareth and me and my mother, went to stay with her parents in Holyhead, and he came down to London he had a job already.
So you fitted in really well in the school in Wales?
No, it was shocking. And there's no concession. No concession to the fact that I just looked around me and thought, what on earth is this place? I remember just looking to this day. I can see the national school we were in, and I can see the kind of rawness of it all, and I'm thinking, this is home, you know? Is this really it?
Because your mother was Welsh.
Yeah.
And they spoke Welsh?
All the time. I mean, they all spoke Welsh. Everybody spoke Welsh. There was no concession to me as a non-Welsh-speaking pupil. None at all. Probably they didn't know any English. I mean, I haven't got a clue, really, what the Welsh knew.
Why would they?
But none at all. So that was really very, very confusing for me, a very confusing time.
Okay. And we'll come to this later, but obviously you've still got a huge connection with Wales, but we'll come to that later on. However, your next track, David...
Yeah, is Richard Burton and Under Milk Wood. And if you know it, I just think it's the most fabulous bit of prose ever. And it's just the way this guy just takes it and makes it alive and just makes it part of his language. Speaking is just the most fundamental way we communicate with each other.
To begin at the beginning. And all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now.
Excellent. So it's good, isn't it? I love the music. So,
some of us, this is music.
I know.
You know.
It is.
The
it
Welsh
is.
Language.
You're right, it is. So you moved to London and you were at school in Tooting Broadway.
Tooting Beck first.
Oh, Tooting Beck, sorry.
Do you mind? Tooting Beck and then Tooting Broadway. So I really count myself as a kind of South London boy, really. Yes, so Mr. Coombs was the headmaster of Franciscan Road Junior School I went into. Mr. Green was our form teacher. Mr. Taylor was the music teacher. And these people have enormous significance for us. We stop and think about it. It's suddenly all... And Mr. Coombs did an assembly every morning. And all my introduction to God was breathing exercises.
Breathing exercises.
Breathing. You know, he would say, a big man, a huge man. So in and out. And he did that with his hands to demonstrate what would happen to our lungs or something like that. So
and that was your introduction to God?
That was my introduction to God.
Fair enough. Next brother, Christopher,
was born
while you were there.
He was born in St. James's Hospital in Balham.
Yes. So tell me about your mum and dad. Were they sort of similar?
No. To put it bluntly, no.
Tell us about your mum first.
Pardon?
Tell us about your mother.
Mum was Welsh-speaking. Mum was very... Mum was quite a kind of protectively insular person because part of the culture, I think, is to protect what you've got. I think it's very much a protectionist nation, really. It likes to protect its identity and therefore it likes to protect its language. My mother and my aunt, her twin sister, only spoke Welsh to each other, even in company, even in front of the family. Probably just to keep it up, but, you know, just to...
That's strange, actually, because Liz and I only talk English to each other as well, even in company. Weird.
There's no answer to that. I can't think of an answer to that one. I'm really sorry. Yes, let's move on.
Okay, and your dad?
Dad was set up his own business in advertising, and he was just so busy that he was one of these kind of absent dads. You know, you think that they're a thing of the present. They're not. They were also present in the past as well. And Dad was very much... Dan was actually quite gifted. He used to illustrate for the Eagle and for Dan Dare and all that sort of thing. He had to invent the stories. So if you got the job, you had to invent the story as well as illustrate it as well. So he did a lot of that.
So it's quite likely that, unknown to me as a child, I would have read some of your dad's stories with his illustrations.
Yeah, you might have. Yes, you might have ogled at his illustrations and wondered at his literary prowess. But you might not have.
I may not have done. Yes, okay. But music was important to you during that time.
Yeah, really important. I was hauled up. Mr. Stewart was our music teacher when I went to secondary school, and he kind of identified me as the only pupil who was able to sing the first verse of Once in Royal David City every time we had the school carol concert at All Saints Brudenell Road before we moved, the school moved somewhere else. So it was very much put up front, you know, even in the assembly hall, I sang the first verse, you know, and in this great big Temple Moor was the architect church. It was just fabulous to sing in that big church. Music was important.
Yes, and
I played the violin. I played the violin, and I'm on a record. I'm on a record published by the Greater London Council for Schools Orchestra, and I played the violin in it.
I did not know that.
There's a lot you don't
There's
know.
There's an awful lot I don't know, that's right. So listening to music at home on the radio?
Oh, music on the... fabulous, yes. I was besotted with the radio. It was great. We had a radio in New Zealand, which was one of those kind of plastic radios. But here, it was a bigger... It stood about that big, the radio, valve radio, and big speakers underneath. And I would listen to Frank Chaxfield. I don't know if you remember, but it was got a palm court orchestra kind of thing. If people are nodding, thank goodness. So it's not that.
Shows your age.
Exactly. But the palm court, and every Sunday morning, 3 to 4, I would sit in front of the radio, nick one of my mother's knitting needles, and I would conduct the orchestra. I would conduct it every unknown to me, my father had written to the BBC and said, my son is besotted with Frank Chaxfield. He wrote the music to Limelight, which is Charlie Chaplin's music, and he made it popular, did Frank Chaxfield. And he'd written to the BBC, and he said, we're going out, we're going out. And I didn't know where we were going, but we went to the Shepherd's Bush Theatre. I didn't know we were going there. I didn't know what I was walking into. But it's the BBC rehearsal theatre. And it, you know, I get terribly emotional about this because I'm very close to my dad. And I walked into the theatre and I sat in the front row. I was the only person in the theatre apart from the BBC Light Orchestra in front of me. And I was introduced to Frank Chatfield. And then he said, "Would you like to have a go?" Knitting needle. So he gave me the conductor's baton and I stood on the rostrum and I conducted this orchestra in a cack-handed way. But frankly, I could have been doing anything. I could have been stitch one, no, you know, pearl two or whatever it is. And they were going to play it anyway. And it was... Let's just have it.
Yeah, so obviously that's sort of an emotional memory for you, David.
It was huge. I mean, your relationship with your father is built on so many things that, in a sense, they just do for you. They just do it, and they do it without thinking. And Dad did that without really even speaking to me about it. And yes. It was one of those key moments that kind of draw you close to one of your parents. Very important.
Sure. So, in preparation for secondary school, I mean, like lots of people, you took the 11 plus. No doubt you absolutely nailed it.
And failed it. Part of the problem was that we'd moved such a lot and such a lot
was
happening.
Sounds like an excuse, David.
The problem was we'd moved and moved such a lot.
Sounds like an excuse, David.
I'm not going to say it a third time, Jim. And there's no sense of settledness. And I failed. And Mr. Green, our teacher, called me aside at the end. And he said, "David, I can show you where you did the one question you got wrong, which slipped you back rather than, well, slipped you anyway, really." And it was a question about rabbits. So the question was, four rabbits each have four baby rabbits. How many rabbits are there altogether? Oh, go on, answer it.
Well, I know, because we've already talked about this.
Yeah, we did, and I got it wrong, and I knew I'd got it wrong, and he was just so nice to me. So off to secondary school, you know, this is a South London boy in a secondary school. This is serious schooling. This is about learning to... This is Roger the Dodger stuff. This is really... learning to be quick on your feet and to be ahead of the game if you could possibly be.
Okay, and so what was the sort of form of discipline there at the secondary school?
Well, I have a theory that all these people, they should have been born in another era, all the teachers, when corporal punishment was de rigueur and you just did it every day to anything that moved, really. And I remember Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson was our PE teacher, and... He said, I never understood the logic, I'm going to slipper the last person out. Well, someone's going to be the last person out, and yeah, there's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy about that, really. So, you know, I made sure I wasn't. I mean, that's what you do, isn't it? And Mr. Smith, the maths teacher, he just wheeled, I can hear it to this day, he just wheeled with the cane every lesson without fail. And I didn't. I've failed to miss that quite often.
Right, okay.
I didn't learn anything.
No, well, learn to dodge.
Probably. I learned to dodge.
Yes, that's right.
And to duck and dive and, you know.
So you're at school, bit of Amdram there?
Yeah, the Junior Drama League was important. Oliver, we did. I remember that well. I had a little part in that. I really loved that. Mr. Lovegrove was our drama and English teacher with Huey Turner. But Mr. Lovegrove was really good, really switched on, just saw the potential in pupils. Really, he was a light in the darkness of secondary education in Tooting Beck, you know, in South London at that time.
Sure.
He was great.
Sunday mornings for you, what were they like?
Sunday mornings are interesting. I went to every Sunday school that I possibly could. I cottoned on to what your parents do on a Sunday after they send you to the nearest Sunday school because it gives them an hour and a half off looking after you. That's what they did to me. So I went to the Methodist Church, the Presbyterians, the Church of England, and I went to one other as well, and I can't quite place it. but to the Anglican church as well, just down the road.
Did the rounds.
What?
You did the rounds.
I did the rounds, yeah. Well, okay. Why wouldn't you?
And so... Were there any sort of important events for you, sort of church-wise, around that sort of time?
Yeah, I was converted at St Nicholas Church in Tooting Broadway. Huge church, really important. And it was so insignificant, my conversion, that it's almost, you could just pass it by. I remember the sermon being preached, I knew where I was sitting, and I listened to the preacher, and I thought, this is significant, this is quite important. I might just as well give all I know of myself to what I know of this God that I'm being invited to have a relationship with. So, you know, at the age of, I think it was about 12 or 14, I did it.
Okay.
I should do it.
And so this was at St Nicholas's.
St Nicholas. Yeah. In Tooting, yeah.
And obviously you brought some of that back home with you in terms of your fervour for that. In terms of your sister Anne?
My sister Anne is permanently in a home. She is a highly significant member of our family, but completely unable to do anything for herself. She's in a home in North Wales. But she was well up to the age of four when she had a very bad dose. I mean, you might have seen it years ago in The Observer. There was a big campaign of preschool booster. And she succumbed to it, got encephalitis in Atkinson Morley Hospital, all sorts of things. But before that, I was so enamoured with this idea that I could pray that I used to kneel beside her cot and pray, learn, teach her how to pray, and prayed with her the Lord's Prayer. And we did that stuff. And it was just normal for me to do it. Why wouldn't you do it? You know, it's just what you do. You know, it's the way it happens. And I remembered up to the age of four, praying with my sister and just helping her to say this little Lord's Prayer with me every evening, almost every evening without fail, as many as I can remember anyway.
And so obviously that illness for your sister and the way that she sort of became disabled in that way obviously had a profound effect on the family.
It tore us apart in many ways, really. I think it fractured the family really very badly. I think it tore my mother apart. My father was run ragged, trying to maintain his business, trying to maintain the family, look after my mother, look after the children. It was a miracle that he survived. He survived peritonitis and a small cancer of his lower intestine. And he was fine after that. I mean, after they operated on him, he was absolutely fine. And he lived to 84, 85, something like that.
And Christopher?
Chris went away to school. My parents thought he'd had too much exposure to the trauma of my sister's illness. And my uncle paid for him to go away to school just to get him out of the family, which to this day, I think, was probably a mistake. I think that was a mistake, yes. Really, to remove him among all the brothers, because there were now three brothers, of course, and a sister, so four of us in the family. Yeah. And I don't think that was right. But, you know, I was not old enough to protest or wise enough to say the right things at the right time, really.
And so your next bit of music is a Beach Boys bit of music. I think it's particularly poignant, and I don't know if you've related it, what the actual title is, to what we've just been talking about.
What have I chosen? What's the next piece?
Don't Worry Baby.
What? Don't Worry Baby. Yeah. It's to do with moving on. So I went to Wimbledon School of Art, and then I went to Wimbledon School of Art, and then I went to Brighton College of Art, and that was great. Raymond Briggs, Snowman, taught me. I had the most fabulous teachers ever, really. They were just great guys. And I learned met a lot of really interesting, fabulous people, but we had a record player, and there was a battle going on between Bach's cantatas and fugues and all the rest of it, and the Beach Boys. So the Beach Boys won every time, and I thought it was so unfair, but this is one of the tracks that was played continually. There at Wimbledon. I was at Wimbledon.
You're jumping ahead here, David.
Sorry.
So, whilst you're at secondary school, obviously you came to O levels and things like that.
Yeah.
And being a sort of a fluent French speaker nailed your oral.
Oh, this is so embarrassing.
That's why I didn't want you to jump ahead.
This is so embarrassing. So, in my day, there was French language and French oral. Yep. So, French oral was what I was doing. I'm wondering how I was going to get through it if the question was ever asked that you couldn't answer because you didn't understand what was being asked. So I devised this plan. You see, being a South London boy, you have to duck and dive and weave, and you had to work out the best permutations to get where you want at the least expense to yourself. And I decided that I was going to... I thought, if there is one question that comes up that I can't answer, what's the answer going to be? And I hadn't got a clue, except that I knew. And I can't tell you what it is in French anymore, but I paused and tensed the sentence, which in English goes like this, "Oh, madame," because it was a French oral examiner, woman. If I could only answer you as well in French as I might in English, then we just could be here all day. And she asked me the question, and I got this perfect sentence, French, perfect, tenses right, everything. And I flew it back at her, and she just went back and like that, and I thought, gotcha. Or something like that. But it was underhand and thoroughly irregular.
Yes. I'm ashamed of you, David. And but also art...
You're the only person who is. Right?
Art was important at secondary school?
After secondary school, then...
Art.
Art school, straight into business.
No. Art was important to you at secondary school.
Oh, terribly, yeah. Mr. Marjoram was my art teacher. He was great, and he saw potential. And we had a mural. Everybody could do a mural once a term. So I drew this, so I painted this mural. It was the most pretentious nonsense ever, called the nonconformist, you know, rubbish. You know, I just discovered this word, nonconformity, and probably chapel or something like that. I'm not quite sure where it comes from. But I painted this picture, this huge 12x6 mural. And he said, you ought to go to art college. So I did my O-levels and... No, I can't.
No, you can't. Okay, so you moved to Morden, is that right?
To Morden, yeah. Yes. The family then moved again to Morden. Yeah.
Okay, and so the vicar from St Nicholas wrote to the vicar, or the rector at St Morden, to say you were arriving,
yeah.
Which is fantastic. Mm. And so tell us about your first day at the church there.
St Martin's at Morden. Yeah, St Martin's at Morden. Very important to me, really. Even
though you nearly missed it out.
Even
sorry, no, it's all right, it's fine. Keep going.
I see. Yes. Yeah. So I went into the evening service and sat and crept along a road to the very end while I wouldn't be. It was full. And there was a young girl at the other end of the pew who kept a meticulous diary about it. And she wrote in her diary, "Lonely boy at the end of the pew." And it was Anne's diary, and she read. I liked it. Where's the diary? So that was how we first met. And then you went to the grammar school, and I went to the art college, and they were kind of next door to each other, and we kind of kept up that way.
Okay, so that was a significant thing. And so how did you sort of get together, you know, you and Anne? How did you meet up with each other?
You know, I mean, Anne will tell you, I am, everything is going to be played in a minor key, and I am the most introverted person that you could ever have the misfortune to meet. But it took me ages to hold Anne's hand. I really fancied her. I thought she was great, and I still do.
Brownie points.
Yeah, that's right. So that's yep. And I still do. And I think she's terrific for me. What were you asking me?
That's it. Well, so you went to youth clubs and things together, yeah. And that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So obviously you were then at Winchester.
Winchester?
No. Wherever it was.
That's interesting.
Before that, in the...
Wimbledon.
Wimbledon, that's the word, it begins with W.
Wimbledon School of Art.
Wimbledon School of Art.
Yeah.
After that, so it's not the traditional A-level route.
No, I didn't do my A-levels. I got in early to do a two-year course, which was really, Gerald Cooper was the principal. And Gerald looked at my work and said, yeah, you can come in. I think he was just saying that to anybody, really. But Julie Andrews' brother was a fellow student, and that's the... Just throw that in, really. But that's nice. It.
And then 3 years at Salisbury.
Brighton.
Oh, dear. Anne was at Salisbury. So you were at Brighton.
Anne was at Salisbury. Anne was at Brighton.
And so a friend used to lend you a car to...
Yeah, a friend lent a car. I used to go over weekends. Used to work my head off until I could... So I could have the weekend as free as I could to go down to Salisbury. Yeah, that's what I did. Yeah.
Okay. And so eventually you decided that you were going to ask Anne to marry you.
To what?
Marry you.
Yes, I did. Yeah, that's right. Yes, I'm sorry.
I wasn't proposing, David. I was just...
No, I can't. It's not that I can't believe it. It's just that I can't hear you. And so I asked Anne if you would marry me, and you said yes. But you said yes on Brighton Beach. No, you didn't. We went down to Brighton Beach, and I asked you if... That's it. That's right. In my room. In
David.
My digs. That's how I did.
Dear.
And then we went... You know how it is,
you know
Jim?
That, you know that brownie... Unfortunately, I don't know how it is. That...
Oh, really? No.
Anyway, another piece of music, David.
Yeah, my introduction to jazz. There was a guy called Howard Bennington in my class who was just too cool for his own good, really. He would disappear up himself if he was any cooler. And he introduced me to Dave Brubeck. And I went to see Dave Brubeck and the Dave Brubeck Quartet. And this is live at the Festival Hall. And this is for... Where is Mr. Birmingham? Where is he? This is for you and for me, because you used to buy your cymbals in the same shop that Joe Morello, Dave Brubeck's drummer, bought his. And I take my hat off to you. And the ground on which you walk is holy.
It makes you smile, doesn't it? It really does. Okay, we're moving along here, David. So, Anne was teaching in Twickenham.
She was.
And you're in Chelsea. And it's when you...
Chelsea?
That's what I've got written here.
Well, you read it wrong.
Oh, okay. And so you started working as a graphic designer.
Yeah, I did.
Can you sort of just talk us through that sort of part of your career?
Yeah, that was really good, because I worked for this building company called Waits Builders. They're the biggest land bank in the south of England. But they could afford to employ some of the coolest designers, like Terence Conran and his group, and they employed them to commission them to design all their exhibitions or their new housing developments everywhere. And so they did the exhibitions, we did the graphics, and we did all the other work that went on. It was great. Dick Senior was my boss, and he was a great boss. He taught me in 4 years in 4 hours, as much as I ever learnt technically in at art college. He was a great guy. Great guy. Your first boss you never forget, in that particularly in this discipline.
Okay, so 5 years into your marriage, another significant event, which was Daniel.
Daniel. And we bought on record. I bought Elton John's Daniel. And I bought it just to commemorate his birth. He wrote that lovely song about Daniel. So we bought that. Yeah, and he was born in Hampton.
And just to sort of summarise it, so you have three other children as well as Daniel.
Okay, you want to cut to the chase. Yes, there are three other children, yeah. Daniel, Zoe, Abigail and Hannah.
Excellent. So after Waits, then where?
From Waits to British Oxygen, because they just got a new identity from Wolf Olins. And Wolf Olins had wanted to get a team together in British Oxygen to implement this new corporate identity. And that was really good fun. Barry Robinson was my boss. He was a great guy. He went on to be chief designer at the post office afterwards. Great job he had. And then after that, I went to, so that was two big jobs. I really enjoyed those two jobs. And then I went to a design office in Knightsbridge called Murdoch Design Associates. And Peter Murdoch had worked with Lance Wyman, who designed all the graphics for the Mexico 68 Olympics. I don't know if you remember them, but they were outstanding. If you want to go back and look how a graphic designer can really encapsulate the culture and the graphics of this in one event, it's Lance Wyman's stuff.
So is there anything we would know that you've designed, David?
Yeah. I designed the William Hill logo, and I designed it 45 years ago, and they're still renewing it and refreshing it. Every shop, every stadium, everywhere. It haunts me. It just... and it haunts me for good reasons, because they should have darn well changed it. 20 years ago, they should have changed it, but they haven't.
David, do you get the royalties?
Okay, so that's a long time working in graphic design. Tell me about Robert Crossley.
Robert Crossley had officiated at our marriage. Robert was a great... Yes, you can. Thank you. Robert Crossley was the curate at St. Martin's, and he made me kind of with Anne in charge of the youth groups and all sorts of things. We had a great time there. And Robert said, you ought to be thinking of ordination. Just on... I don't know. But he did, and it kind of chimed with me. Because I do think, in terms of ordination, you have to be called out of something you really enjoy doing into something else. It's not that ordination is... Well, I'm not very good at that, but I'll try and be, you know, ordained somewhere else. Perhaps the Church of England will have me or something like that. And I loved what I was doing, and to let go of it was huge. It really is. To this day, it's huge. You know, we've spoken about it, and I think it's as huge to me this to this day. But I went to Ridley Hall in Cambridge. Went to Ridley Hall for a couple of years. Got ordained and went off to all my jobs as an ordained man have been jobs in the Diocese of Southwark and in Croydon, Sanderstead, then to Hawley, and then to Streatham, and then to Clapham. And when we left Hawley to go to Streatham, I remember somebody counselling me against doing it because of the children. Because Hawley's near Gatwick Airport, and I still believe to this day that most of the residents of Hawley believe that the tundra starts at Croydon. No trees grow beyond there. It's all wasteland. Wasteland. And we were counselled not to do it.
So it was 4 years as a curacy.
4 years of curacy.
Then 6 years at Hawley.
7 years at Hawley. 6 or 7 years at Streatham Common. Streatham was great. We loved Streatham.
Okay, why?
It was my first introduction to a real multicultural congregation. It was outstanding. There were some wonderful people there. And I just remember, you know, just going back to that Pitcairn Islands introduction to that black guy for the first time. And then just walking into Streatham thinking, wow, this is something else altogether. And it was the kind of culture and the integrity of all these people who weren't living a particularly comfortable life, but just knew God in all the mess that was going on and all the joy that was going on at the same time.
So from there, so Clapham Common... in 1995, as the team rector for numerous parishes.
Oh, ridiculous. Six parishes in with a total parish population of 35,000, which is ridiculous. Absolutely. What on earth they were doing, I hadn't got a clue. But I was drawn to Clapham, to Holy Trinity, because in a plaque that was about that big was half a reference to William Wilberforce worshipped here. And I knew he was the Clapham saint. And I knew that he was Bible Society and CMS and the abolition of the slave trade. And I thought, what contribution can I make to this? So I applied for the job. I had 20 people interviewing me because it was a team ministry. So everybody, you know, has to be represented. And at the end, the bishop said to me, have you got anything you want to ask us or tell us? And I said, yes. I said, I want you to know this. That if you are going to appoint me, and, you know, I look forward to the phone call later on today. If you are going to... No, it might be, no, we're not going to appoint you, or we're going to delay, or we'll do something else, or we'll appoint you. And I said, if you are going to appoint me, then you need to know who you're appointing and where I come from or what stable I come out of, so that if there is a problem in the future, I can remind you about the interview process, and I can remind you that this is what you signed up for. And I was glad I did that, because it was a tough time.
Yes, and so, I mean, one of the significant things you did was you moved your six parishes into three, which is obviously a hard thing to do.
5 years it took us to do that.
Yeah, but then bicentenary.
Bicentenary of the Abolition of the Slave Trade Act was 1807, and I knew in 2003-04, that that date was coming up and could be in 2007, the bicentenary could be significant. It could be significant for the Church of England, but it also could be significant to the nation as well, and particularly where we were living then, cheek by jowl with Brixton, Stockwell. You know, this could be some visceral stuff if you don't handle it properly. And so we launched the debate in General Synod, and then we launched it to the government. And there are one or two stories, we haven't got time, but one or two really interesting stories about how you take a bike off Whitehall, because I only went by bike, has railings which said if any bike is placed against these railings, it will be unchanged and probably blown up somewhere on the embankment. So I walked into the cabinet office with my bike up like this, and I got through one of those metal detector revolving doors with my bike. And the man at the other side of the door said, "How on earth did you do that? You know, this is posh land. This is cabinet office. I haven't got a clue. I just didn't want to leave my bike outside."
Fair enough.
Right.
And so this next piece of music is significant for the bicentenary.
Yeah, we commissioned John Waits the Builders, and the PCC and the rector of the PCC, Clapham, commissioned a piece of music called Mighty River. And it was a play on Amazing Grace. And Erin M. Warren is a significant black composer, and we commissioned it, and we crammed the Philharmonia Orchestra into Holy Trinity for its premiere, and the place was full and rocking. It was just extraordinary. Who am I? You know, this is happening there. What? How did that happen?
So can we hear a bit of
just
it?
Just a bit of it, yeah, just a bit.
So just to sort of take us back just a fraction, 10 years before you retired, you decided to look for somewhere to retire to.
Yeah.
So went in search of somewhere to sort of settle after your ministry. Yeah. And you ended up here. I mean, you chose here. Why did you choose this area from Clapham Common?
Well, you don't have to say we ended up here. I mean...
Here?
We ended up here. We ended up here because we could afford a house here. We wanted a good church, and I have a little dinghy which I sail occasionally, and I wanted somewhere where I could launch it. And those were the three reasons. Actually, it's more than that. A friend of mine, John Alderman, was the patronage secretary for the Church Pastoral Aid Society, and John was in touch with all the decent churches around this area, well, over the country. But I said, give me six around here, and that will help us to focus on where we want to live and what church we want to go to. Actually, for a Christian, having a church to go to has been the most fundamentally important bit of our joining and our identity and our belonging, and it's really worked for us.
So
it's worked for me.
What was it that attracted you to St. John's?
No roof appeal. Didn't work, did it? No roof appeal. No fundraising for anything. That didn't work either. What appealed to me was just the warmth of the welcome of the vicar before last. The vicar before last?
Peter Ingrams.
And Peter made space for us at an evening service. And I thought, gosh, if you can get up out of your seat and do that for me, I think this might be the place that we're looking for. And that just swung it for us, really. That was the... It's all about relationships and all about just making a connection. That's the way it works.
Sure. So you bought a house in Streamlease.
Yeah, about and then 10 years ago.
10 years, yeah. Yeah. And then rented it out until eventually you retired.
Yeah.
Was there anything that prompted you into actual retirement? Because obviously you were hanging on with your fingernails to the job.
I thought I was far too important to retire. That was a lesson I had to learn it was a very difficult lesson. I didn't want to leave. Anne was absolutely bang on. I had something called acute pancreatitis and had presented myself twice to a hospital saying there's something seriously wrong with me. And they sent me home saying, well, I'd take paracetamol and Gaviscon for that if I was you. And then I ended up in St. Thomas's for a month altogether with, you know, desperately ill. And it was kind of one of those signals that actually, if you carry on like this, you need to know when you're going to stop, and you need to listen very carefully to what your body, let alone your wife, is actually saying to you at that time.
Sure.
And that was the crisis for me.
And I know that sort of leaving there was very, very difficult, and sort of a bit of a sort of a grieving process that happened, actually leaving Clapham Common, because that was such an important place for you.
Yeah.
But you came here and took some advice from David Wilson, about the only person who has. And that was a joke, David. That was a joke.
You are right.
Took a year sort of sabbatical that you didn't get involved in too much.
David's advice to us, I remember sitting in the garden, and perhaps Jan and David will remember, sitting in the garden surrounded by packing cases. And David just came up and said, it's a sabbatical year you need. It's take it as a sabbatical year. Just don't do anything. Don't revert to the previous job you've had before retirement. Don't think that you can just pick up the reins and do it all again, and don't be indispensable.
Are we thinking?
And I'm really grateful for that. I know he's sitting hiding behind somebody else over there, but it was the best advice ever that I had at that time.
So you took a year just to sort of find yourself, and you say that Anne is very much a nester and sort of wants to build a home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of women are, but Anne is supremely the nester that I needed at that time, because I was very discombobulated by the whole business.
Okay. But then, since then, you've been involved in lots of things. So, I mean, just to go very briefly, so we're looking at sort of obviously leading services, working with Messy Church, having a home group, walking with the walking group, sailing your dinghy, those sorts of things, you know. But then you've got some other important things that you do as well. So writing and drawing, can you tell us about
that? Oh, I love drawing. I've rediscovered drawing. I do some writing now and again, fits and starts, really. I've written a piece called Brown Shoes, which a friend of ours, Glenda, what's her name, has looked at and said, beautiful writing, but I don't understand a word of it, she said. And she teaches at City Lit in London. But I like writing, but I've also fallen in love with drawing. And I know I've got other people here who are far more competent drawers than me. And but I love drawing. And whenever I go out, I have a little pad, sketch pad, that's about that big. And I have a biro that's very soft, and I'll draw the back of anybody's head, because I'm always sitting behind somebody else's head and just enjoying doing that. And I have a little sketchbook that's now filling up with the backs of people's heads. I know what you look like from the back, really.
So there's all these things, but then obviously then there's the most important thing, which is badminton.
Do you know, Jim, my life would fall apart if it wasn't for the fact that you invited me to badminton on Friday night. And I cancel diary events for badminton, Jim, and I'd cancel anything in order just to be there, just expending energy and flicking that racket and what's going on and falling over. And you've been a great teacher to me, because I'd never played badminton until I came here, and it was just great to learn that I can have a new skill at this age. Really, decrepitude is setting in, and I'm 73, and can I continue to wield a badminton racket, you know? But I can, and I love it, and I like the people,
which is just as well. And also the Art Society.
Yeah, art society. I mean, amongst people who belong to art society and go to art society, and it's really important, art society. Partly because I think, as a Christian, we've been at the forefront of the arts, for millennia, across hundreds and hundreds of years, and we seem to have lost contact with how we kind of harness the arts properly again. And to be involved in the art society is a way of me giving a bit of just exercise, stretching that bit of me that would not otherwise be stretched if I didn't belong to such an august company of people. It's great. Anybody can. By the way, if you're not a member of Art Society, as the vice chair of Salisbury Green Art Society, I do recommend it. Come and speak to me or James or Howard or anybody else that belongs to Art Society, and we'll introduce you to the wonderment and the beautifulness of it all.
Excellent.
Is that right?
And obviously, that's great. And obviously, you also have a starring role in an upcoming performance.
It's called The Miracle.
Miracle.
Yes.
And David, true to his sort of Christian upbringing and curious ear and all the other ministry bits, is going to be Pontius Pilate. Why is this next bit of music, the U2 bit of music, important for you, David?
Well, U2 was, when I was in Clapham, Dan, our son, who's the most avid U2 fan you'll ever come across, he couldn't go to one of the big Wembley shows. This is about 10, 12 years ago, it must be. And he said, take the tickets. So I took it, and I learned two important lessons in Wembley for a big U2 concert. First of all, the seat that folds down, there are millions of them really in there, it's not for sitting on. So I sat down on it, and I expected somebody to say to me, are you feeling all right? You're okay, because it's not what you do. So I then noticed that everybody, actually, when they came on, it's just great, a great show, started standing on the seats. That's what you do. That's what the seat is for. Not for sitting on, for standing on. But the second lesson I learned was how old I was, because the lady who was standing next to me just looked at me and said, do you want a hand? And I thought, cheeky, yes.
And the significance of this particular piece of music?
The significance of this particular music is that when we left Clapham, it was at the end of the service, it was the piece of music that was played as we walked out. It's a beautiful day.
So, David, we're coming to... I know, I can't help it, because we need to move on. We're coming to sort of the end now. If you were to choose one book, apart from, of course, the Bible that you know off by heart, and The Complete Works of Shakespeare, what book would you choose to take with you onto a desert island?
Well, it's a book I've read twice in a very short... And it's become a book that I'm slightly obsessed with. So you take the things that you're obsessed with, you think you can't do without. And it's a book... it's called Self-Portrait by Celia Paul. Thank you. Sorry, just got it for me a minute. By Celia Paul. She's a fantastic artist. And she, her father was a Bishop of Bradford. But she's a world, internationally renowned artist. And it just reminds me that actually the kind of church has kind of lost contact with that kind of thing. It doesn't know how to react to it. So that would be the book that I would take and read and read and read again.
And a luxury?
I take the best box of oil paints that were available, the biggest, that would last me forever, and hidden and secreted in there would be lots of brushes, and wrapped around all the tubes would be all the paper I need.
That feels like cheating, but that'll do.
It's all in one box.
Now, ordinarily, we would say which one track of the tracks that you've chosen would be the one that you keep. However, we have a final track. Yeah. Can you just say a tiny bit about that?
Yeah, it's Gerald Finzi. If anybody knows Gerald Finzi's work, he's one of the great pastoral 1930s, 40s composers. And he's written this piece called Lo, the Full Final Sacrifice. And There's an amen at the end, and for me it kind of sums up the whole of my life. I pray that one day there will be an amen in my heart to all that's happened. For all that has happened, I will be grateful. For all that shall be and is to come, I'll be able to say yes, and the amen will be the yes that I would like to say. And it's Gerald Finzi's amen at the end of his piece. Amen.
when I'm normally preparing these, I'd say to whoever it is I'm going to be talking to, give me about 2 hours of your time so I can talk through your life. And I said the same to David, give me about 2 hours of your time so I can talk through your life. And initially we were going to go into David's office with a stool like this for me to sit on. And he said, it's only going to be 45 minutes. 3 hours later, we sort of came. So trying to fit your life, David, into 45 minutes hasn't quite worked, but we have managed an hour, which is pretty good. Can I just say, David, thank you so much. Thank you for doing this, but also just thank you for everything that you give to the people in this parish and to your friends who truly love you. David Isherwood, everybody.